Paul Kicks says a photograph convinced him to write a book about the history of race relations.
And I thought to myself, well, not just that photo, but the surrounding campaign might be a book project. And that book project very quickly became a family project of sorts, because I really thought that perhaps if I told this story of Birmingham, which, by the way, had never been told, this is the most shocking thing to me as I began to research it more. The civil rights canon might be as deep as any in American letters. However, there is not one, until this book, there is not one book that just focuses on those 10 weeks in Birmingham. My name is Paul Kicks. I am a writer and author, and my latest book is called You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live. It's a long title, but it's a quote that comes from Fred Shuttlesworth, who is one of the leaders of Project Confrontation, which is the focus of my book. That focus are the 10 weeks in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, that I believe not only changed the course of the civil rights movement, but changed the course of America. And its repercussions and effects are felt even today, and especially even in my own household.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Joining us is a journalist, Paul Kicks, who lives in Connecticut, talking about his book with that long title. You already established what I was going to ask you about that. That title, You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live. I thought it was going to be part of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, but it was not. What was it?
So it actually came before the letter from Birmingham jail. It comes from a pastor in Birmingham, and his name is Fred Shuttlesworth. And this is actually really fascinating. So the Birmingham campaign was easily the biggest gamble of the SCLC's campaign, its history, but there was in some sense a larger gamble at play, and that was how to finance it. So SCLC leaders, just prior to the campaign start in April, they go to Harry Belafonte's apartment in New York. The SCLC is completely broke by this point, and they're trying to find a way to do a fundraiser that will actually, you know, allow them to stage a multi-week and very likely multi-month and almost certainly very brutal and bloody campaign in Birmingham. As they're meeting there, the headliner of that night is, again, this pastor from Birmingham named Fred Shuttlesworth. And Fred is just basically recounting tales of his life from Birmingham, the only pastor involved in the Birmingham campaign who was actually from Birmingham. In fact, arguably the only pastor in Birmingham, the only activist in Birmingham who had the courage to stare down Bull Connor, the public safety commissioner, and who had barely cloaked ties to the Ku Klux Klan, who operated his police department in a manner as corrupt and racist and violent as Bull himself was. And in any case, Fred Shuttlesworth is telling stories from his encounters with Bull Connor. Those encounters include the times that, say, he walked into a line trying to get his two high school age daughters into a white run high school. And he was met by brass knuckles. He was met by metal bats, by lead pipes. He nearly died in that camp. He nearly died that day. He told stories about how he threatened to try to integrate the bus lines in Birmingham. And as a result, the night before that integration, his home was bombed, completely detonated. He said that the last thing that he wanted to do was allow segregation to reign in Birmingham. Yet as a result of this, his home is bombed. And the next day, he has the temerity to say, I am going to go ahead and try to integrate the bus lines. And he did that day. This was a man of unending courage. And these were the sorts of stories that were relayed that night in Harry Belafonte's apartment. And as a result of that, some of the people in New York, and these are Hollywood producers, these are newspaper publishers, these are Hollywood stars themselves, Harry Belafonte had assembled 75 of the richest and deepest pocketed New Yorkers. And they ask him, how exactly do you have the courage to do this? And Fred says in response, well, you have to be prepared to die before you can begin to live. Mm. And that line just wowed the donors. And as a result of that, the Birmingham campaign, otherwise known as Project Confrontation, was able to officially begin in the spring of 1963, so 60 years ago this spring.
The name Shuttlesworth is very familiar to me, but not from the context of the civil rights leader that you're describing. The name actually spelled a little differently. It was Shuttleworth, and these were all white men who were from England who founded carpet mills in Amsterdam, New York, where I grew up. And in fact, my father ended up working for the Shuttleworth brothers. You've never heard of that, have you? Or have you? Is there any connection between the Shuttleworths of the carpet industry and Fred Shuttlesworth?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
So you've explained it, a good point about why they're focusing on Birmingham, but why? Why did they put such effort into one city in America?
Birmingham, in those years, was the most violent, the most racist city in all of America. And that was saying something for the Jim Crow South. We tend to forget this today from the perspective of when we think about history. We have, especially when it concerns the civil rights movement, we have almost this angelic hue that we cast upon those years as if everything were preordained, as if, of course, these guys would succeed. And that was just simply not the case. Leave aside the fact that the SCLC was broke. They were terrified of going to Birmingham, and for good reason. The Klan castrated black men. The cops, Birmingham cops, raped black women and in the cops' patrol cars. Edward R. Murrow, CBS's Edward R. Murrow, he goes to Birmingham just prior to Martin Luther King's own campaign there. And he says, I have not seen anything like this place since Nazi Germany. There was a neighborhood in Birmingham that was known as Bombingham, literally called Bombingham by public officials for all of the homes that were dynamited and all of the murders and sabotages that went, quote, unsolved. Within that neighborhood, there was a subsection of a neighborhood called Dynamite Hill, because that's how well known it was that, like, the Klan and Bull Connor ran this city by fear. So to go to Birmingham was really to confront the total terror that white people could visit upon black people. And that was exactly why the SCLC chose it, because their aim was fairly simple. It had been 100 years now since emancipation, from 1863 to 1963. And in no way was America equal. In no way were black people the equal of whites. And the only thing that the SCLC could think to do, and this was not just the work of Martin Luther King. In fact, my book focuses a great deal on people like Shuttlesworth and other deputies within the SCLC, like James Bevel and Wyatt Walker. What those deputies began to convince King of was that if they could go to Birmingham, and if Birmingham public officials would act as they historically had, which was with absolute violence and brutality, then perhaps those images, if they could get the New York Times to come and scribble notes about them, or Walter Cronkite's camera crew to come and film some of this footage, those images, that featured footage, perhaps it could make its way to the Kennedy brothers. And if it's made its way to the Kennedy brothers, perhaps, maybe, Bobby and Jack would do what they had forsworn ever doing, which was sponsor civil rights legislation. That was the one thing that the SCLC wanted. And that was the one thing the Kennedy administration was dead set against providing, primarily because Jack and Bobby knew that civil rights legislation would not help Jack win in 1964.
We're talking with Paul Kicks. His book, You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live, about 1963, Birmingham, Alabama. Let me propose another detour, but this is one of your making. You have two photographs that you focus on, one from 1963 in Birmingham and one from a more recent day. What are those photos and how are they similar?
So I am a white man. I'm married to a black woman. Her name is Sonia. We have three kids. We have now a 13-year-old daughter and twin 11-year-old boys. After the kids were born, in particular after the boys were born, I just began to read books about the civil rights movement and a lot of other books just to better acquaint myself with like what it would mean to raise kids who would identify as black. And so that led me to the civil rights canon. Reading a lot of those books, I came across this image of a 15-year-old boy in Birmingham. That image appeared May 3rd, 1963. So 60 years ago this month. And that image showed 15-year-old Walter Gadsden being attacked by a German shepherd whose leash was held by a Birmingham cop. And the image was so arresting, in part because the dog wasn't just attacking, but more or less feasting on him. You can see the snarled jaws. You can see how the dog is basically closing those jaws around the midsection of Gadsden's, the right oblique of Gadsden's midsection. But that's not really why the image is arresting. The image is arresting because Gadsden's face is serene. There is this sense that this image, even Gadsden knew that this image would be studied for generations to come. It just begs that there's something about this that makes it sort of transcend its moment. In the same way, and perhaps to put it in a somewhat more modern context, the very famous image of the falling man from 9/11. The New York Times ran that photo, and I'm sure we've all seen it, but it's one of the people who jumped out of the Twin Towers. And the way that that image was captured by an Associated Press photographer, with his arms as if he's like an arrow going straight down, and there's a serenity to that image as well, even though there's terror and horror all around him. That image was so arresting for the same reason that this Gadsden image was. And so for a very long time, I looked at that image and I thought to myself, all of America is contained in this image. There is in this image the violence that white people visited upon blacks. There is the dignity with which black people responded. There is this sense that what came of this violent and awful moment was a newly formed America. And in the horror of this moment, you also find the transcendence of the moment and the transcendence that would sort of then move on to America itself. It would transcend this terrible moment and its terrible past. That's why I loved it. But I didn't do anything with it for a really long time until, and this brings it back to the second half of the question you were asking, the second image. And that is of George Floyd dying in June of 2020. That image, so again, I mentioned my wife, Sonia. She grew up in inner city Houston. She grew up one neighborhood over from where George Floyd grew up in Houston. George was the same age as Sonia when he was murdered. He was 46. George went to the same high school as many of Sonia's cousins, Yates High. In fact, one of her cousins, Derek, he knew George back then and remembered like cheering for him as a tight end on the Yates football team that made the state championship game. So I tell you this aspect because George Floyd's death was the first time that Sonia and I did not shield our kids from the coverage of black men being killed by police officers, often very innocent black men being killed by police officers whose footage was captured either by body cam footage or cell phone cameras, as was the case with George Floyd. So we all as a family watched George die on CNN, and our twin boys, who were then 9, had a lot of questions about like what that meant. And these were questions that went beyond like, are all cops bad? Are all cops racist? You could see in some of these questions sort of hints of like, as I say in the book, questions that whose steps led down to self-hatred. Am I inferior? What does this mean for my life? It was a really tough time for Sonia and me the latter half of 2020. And when Jacob Blake was later that summer shot in the back by Kenosha, Wisconsin cops as his three kids screamed from his car, one of our boys ran. The boys saw that footage too, and they ran from the room, and they were, you know, why do they keep trying to kill us? What's going on? There was a lot of despair in the latter half of 2020. There was a lot of cynicism in the latter half of 2020 that America was a place it wasn't worth it. In fact, our kids talked about how they were going to move away from America, go up to Canada, or just move abroad as soon as they possibly could. Some of that, sure, was just sort of childish banter. But within it was this sense that, all right, they need another image. They need another sense of, like, how to live a life with courage and faith and resilience. And so a book, I return to the image, the Gadsden image, and in that sort of contained this whole history of America. And I thought to myself, well, not just that photo, but the surrounding campaign might be a book project. And that book project very quickly became a family project of sorts, because I really thought that perhaps if I told this story of Birmingham, which, by the way, had never been told, this is the most shocking thing to me as I began to research it more, the civil rights canon might be as deep as any in American letters. However, there is not one, until this book, there is not one book that just focuses on those 10 weeks in Birmingham. Everything else is a sort of exhaustive history or details, other aspects of Birmingham. This one just says, no, what was actually the point? Because, again, we had 100 years of Jim Crow from 1863 to 1963. And then after 1963, what do you have? You have the Kennedy brothers in the summer of 1963 saying, okay, we'll sponsor civil rights legislation. After that, that becomes the Civil Rights Act of 64. That becomes the Voting Rights Act of 65. That becomes ultimately King's own martyrdom in 68. And a new life for his country. Not just even the rise of the black middle and upper classes, not even Barack Obama's presidency, but really my ability, all those decades later, to be able to marry Sonia in a former Jim Crow state like Texas, and to now raise our kids where none of us are harassed for who we are. Birmingham, Alabama made all of that possible, and that was the story that I wanted to tell my kids. Mm. Because I think it's vital for them. And I think it's vital for all of us. It's vital for all of us to understand, especially coming out of the pandemic, that there was so much cynicism that I felt coming out of the pandemic. There was so much just sort of bitterness. And it wasn't even necessarily related to the pandemic. It was just sort of one of the offshoots of it, right? And I wanted to write a book that was basically about hope. Not only hope for our country, but a hope for how you in your own life, however you choose to lead your life, might do so with dignity and with courage. And with ingenuity. That's the reason I wrote that book.
Paul Kix is with us. His book is You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live. The Birmingham campaign, you said, was 10 weeks long. It started in May of 1963, right? April of 1963. And again, I'm going back to something that maybe you don't focus on that much. MLK Jr. and him going to jail. Why was he sent to jail?
Oh, that is fascinating in its own right. He was sent to jail because Birmingham public officials basically had this ordinance on its books throughout the city. And it said that they get to choose who could picket or protest in Birmingham. This was, of course, in direct violation of the First Amendment, but this is sort of in keeping with how Southern customs made their own rules and sort of snouted their noses at anything that the federal government might try to do. So the person who approved any sort of picket or demonstration in the city was, and we mentioned this guy's name a minute ago, Bull Connor, the guy who effectively ran Birmingham. So of course he wasn't going to allow King or anybody else to protest. Well, they did anyway. And so the threats began to escalate. It went from, well, you risk imprisonment, to now you will be imprisoned. It went from, well, maybe you'll be in prison for 2 days to now you'll be in prison for at minimum 6 months. It went from, well, here's a $50 bail to ultimately here's a bail that's set at $2,500. This is in 1963 currency. I don't have a calculator in front of me, but it's arguably say that's like basically tenfold bail per person, right? And they wanted the SCLC wanted to try to have hundreds, if not thousands, of people protesting. So on Good Friday, 1963, King decides, after much, much debate within the SCLC and really within himself, whether he should march on Good Friday. He decides ultimately to do so. And that is its own act of faith, not only personal faith, but spiritual faith. Everything that the SCLC had done prior to this had been an abysmal failure. The campaign 1 year prior in 1962 in Albany, Georgia, had ended so poorly that not only was King sneered at by the Southern and Northern press, openly despised by other civil rights groups who thought he was a phony, who thought he did all the talking while they had to do all the walking. And so by 1963, by Good Friday in 1963, King had to wrestle with, well, what's going to happen if I go to prison? Will the campaign survive without me leading it? And he described that first, so he goes and he's arrested, and he describes that first night in prison as, quote, a dungeon. He said he later wrote that it was a dungeon, and never in his life, this is saying something, but never in his life had he worried so much as he worried that first night in Birmingham, Alabama. Well, the second day comes and he's at last allowed to see his lawyer. And his lawyer brings an op-ed that had appeared in a Birmingham paper the day prior. And it was an argument from fellow clergy members basically saying that King was an interloper from Atlanta and that he should leave the problems of Birmingham to the people of Birmingham and that he was causing more problems than he was resolving. And this just infuriated King because, A, he knew a lot of these pastors. He had sometimes argued for integration with some of them, and now he felt they were cowards and they wouldn't actually stand next to him when the time was critical. And B, the argument they were using, that basically how dare he try to stage a campaign when he knew how Bull Connor might respond, it just confounded him because he's like, well, we're trying to have a more just world. I can't acquire that more just world if we don't confront evil. If evil is going to be evil, then it's going to be evil, right? Like you can't give it allowances and say, well, we have to find another way. So I say all that because why was he in prison? He was in prison for those reasons. Why did he end up deciding to basically write on scraps of newsprint and then on toilet paper and dedicate the next week of his life in prison instead of focusing on the campaign to writing this letter? He chose it because of how angry he was with the fellow clergy members and how he also saw that there was a response that he needed to offer that would, again, I want to use that word transcend, move beyond his own circle of fellow clergymen to America to help to understand, like, there is something that we are going for here. And it is divine by God, and we do not have it in the United States, but we must acquire it, and that is freedom, that is liberty.
And did the letter get wide distribution, or it took a while for that to happen, did it not?
It did. So initially, it was not until late May, as the campaign was in its sort of final throes, did the letter reach a larger audience. Initially, it was only published, if memory serves, by a Quaker magazine, and then other editors and writers and journalists saw it, and they began to understand the real power of it. It's one of, if you haven't read, I mean, please, I want you to read the book, but actually, I want you to read the letter from Birmingham Jail, too, because if you haven't actually read it, it's one of the most moving documents. I was giving a reading last night, and somebody said, I think it's better than anything Lincoln ever wrote, and I have to agree. You know, I think it's up there with everything that you would ever want from the Declaration of Independence. In some sense, I think it really is a document of modern liberty.
When did King get out of jail?
Well, here again, it comes back to Harry Belafonte. This is why I love this story, because you have somebody like Harry Belafonte, who spent a fair amount of time in New York, primarily in the city. But for your audience, it might be helpful to know that he lived almost all of his life in New York City. Harry Belafonte, by 1963, had effectively abandoned his film career. Ed Sullivan thought at one point that he was a communist. Hollywood producers thought he was, quote, difficult. Harry refused to star in any movie where he was sort of the kind-hearted, small-minded lead, which he thought was kind of like a propped-up eunuch and was also basically every role that was offered to black men at that time. He effectively, like I said, abandoned his film career, abandoned his music career, and he focused almost entirely on the civil rights campaign. And I just want to frame that today. Imagine any actor in Hollywood of whatever race doing something like that at the height of their absolute power. But he believed so strongly in the movement. And so that's why he became sort of King's consigliere of sorts and one of his key fundraisers. That's why Bobby Kennedy would go to, when King wouldn't respond to him, he would go to Harry Belafonte and be like, can you talk to him, please? And sometimes Harry would, and sometimes Harry wouldn't. But to bring it back to how this, so not only does Harry stage in late March that massive fundraiser at his apartment in New York, but then as King is in prison and completely unsure of how he's going to get out, Harry uses his own money, his own fortune, to say, I'm going to free King on bail, whatever the cost, and I'm going to do the same for a few other leaders who are alongside him, primarily Ralph Abernathy, who was King's best friend and another key player within the Birmingham campaign. And so he did. And that was the sort of act of faith that King was hoping would be rewarded. It was Harry Belafonte and his kindness saying, okay, now this campaign can continue. And when it did, when King comes out, that's when it kind of turns to its next part and the campaign begins to really take off.
We're talking with Paul Kix. We have just about 3 minutes left. What happened in Birmingham after King is out of jail and after this campaign maybe concludes?
After King is out of jail, the Birmingham campaign goes through sort of many waves of violence and counterviolence. And I would say a very good portion of the book details what that is. I'd also say that, like, it's far and away more, A, more graphic, and B, more contextualized than anything you've seen in any documentary that you may have seen of Birmingham. It was really the most dangerous place in America, a site of domestic terror, I really believe. And those brave protesters decided to completely unarmed give themselves over to it. And it is stunning what they did in Birmingham. But ultimately what happens is a Birmingham Accord is signed. The initial aim was for Birmingham to reach some sort of point where it could be integrated. The thinking was Birmingham could become a metaphor. If we can integrate the most violent and segregated place in America, perhaps then other places would want to seek integration. And that's effectively what happened. Over the month of May and into the early days of June, you see city after city, not just throughout the South, but even like in Chicago, in New York City, you see all of these major American ports and thoroughfares deciding, it's black citizens deciding, we too want the sort of freedom that Birmingham, Alabama now has, which places the Kennedy administration in a very difficult spot. They did not want to offer civil rights legislation, but now they felt because they had 50 Birminghams, 100 Birminghams on their hands, that they had to. And the final transformation is Bobby Kennedy moving from sort of cynical protector of Jack Kennedy to open advocate for civil rights based on numerous encounters with King and with what happened in Birmingham. He is the real linchpin. And I think that sort of intellectually and perhaps spiritually, the greatest transformation that happens in this book is actually Bobby Kennedy.
Paul Kix, thank you very much for joining us. He's author of You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live, an account of the Birmingham Project of 10 weeks during the year 1963. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.